and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting broadcast of the Vinnie Eastwood Show from New Zealand, recently voted the best country to live in the entire world, which is great because we're one of the best countries at concealing the fact that our water is contaminated, our beaches are polluted, our waterways indeed are about maybe 60% not safe for humans to swim in. Things like that. Dumping 1080 poison into the mountain ranges and what have you, getting into everybody's flow on ice melt, all of that kind of stuff. And we're thinking about drilling for oil pretty much everywhere around the coast and inland, as well as digging up coal and whatnot. So it's beautiful. It's great. And we've also got laws that make it illegal to troll people, you know? Like a nice little nanny state. To make it all safe, to make it all beautiful, to make you think that it's green and that there's nothing rotting underneath. Welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest is L.A. Marzulli, who is the sequel to L.A. Confidential. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here. It's a great intro. Thanks. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Now, LA, for those of you who don't know, is a host of Politics, Prophecy, and The Supernatural, which I've only just been introduced to in the very recent future. Now, you're going to have to give us a little bit of a background about who you are, what it is you do, how you actually got into it, that kind of thing. But it's one of those shows where you can actually give us the juicy details, and you can talk to quite a bit about it if you want to.
Well, here's the deal. I've been wanting to move to New Zealand since I was about 15 years old. I'm 65 now. And with everything that's going on here in the States, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but one of my mentors, Chuck Missler, moved his whole operation to New Zealand. And I've always had a fondness. I've never been there, want to go there. People have threatened to have me come over and speak at their conferences, of which I would love to do, but I've always had a real special place, and I'm just not, you know, stroking you here. It's like I'm even today I was talking, we got to get out of here, because what's happening here in the States, you want to talk about genocide. I mean, the chemtrails here are unbelievable. But I'm not answering the question, so let me get back here. Look, I've written 9 books, produced 9 full-length documentary films with my business partner Richard Shaw, on everything from the Shroud of Turin to the Torricos to the Nephilim, elongated skulls. We're all over the map. Certainly, we've talked about chemtrails and earthquakes and all the stuff that we see going on the planet. We talk about what's happening over in the Middle East and the ongoing wars that are going on there. Our new TV show is PPS Report, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural Report. It's about to go up on Roku. We've got 5 episodes. We're airing on a few TV stations, growing very slowly, but having a blast doing it. And I'm actually speaking to you from the studio deep in the heart of the Santa Monica Mountains in an undisclosed location somewhere in Southern California.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We're listening to LA in Santa Monica. That's a very bad joke. I'm known for those. You're going to you're gonna have to watch out. There is, of course, this fever that comes over some people that causes them to make things that usually other people think, hey, bro, you're just crazy. You're just stupid, bro. Why are you doing that? Why don't you just get a job and delay all forms of lust and pleasure in your life for a desk job instead, bro? You know, what about having no creative output? Wouldn't that be better than fulfilling your dreams and what have you? Why aren't you doing that, bro? Why aren't you doing that?
Where to begin? Look, quite bluntly and briefly, and with hopefully a bit of brevity and succinction here, I honestly believe that there is a history that we don't know anything about that has been deliberately obfuscated from not only the American people, but the people from the globe. And even in New Zealand, when it talks about the Maori and your ancestors there. And we know that the First Nation people, but there seems to be another race that was there before them. just like here in the United States, there was a race of 9-foot, red-haired, cannibalistic giants that were here in the United States. We've got overwhelming evidence, and I mean overwhelming evidence. And I've written about this in On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 1, 2, the new book coming out, Nephilim Hybrids. Hopefully we'll give, it's not, is it conclusive? No. But with the stuff that we have coming out in Watchers 10 and in the new book, Nephilim Hybrids, discusses this at great length. We've been able to do some DNA testing. The results of that will be there. Carbon-14 dating was tested. So, you know, it's one thing to sit behind a desk or go on the internet and create a book out of other people's research, what they've done, and read all these other books. It's another thing to be in the field. And we do both. I mean, we certainly, you know, do due diligence in museums and archives and all of that. And that's part of what being on the trail is about. But then, you know, we have an archaeological dig in Ohio, which we're still working on. We've got another dig in Ohio, which we're about to start. We've been down to Paracas several times. You know, we've examined these things. We've got archaeologists and anthropologists looking at the artifacts. I was just in North Carolina several weeks ago, and we discovered an artifact there. And that update on ppsreport.com, I don't know how many thousands of hits, but it's up there. It's been picked up by other sites. It was an artifact. Basically, there was a very large pipe. Now, an archaeologist will tell you that that's ceremonial. But we had Chief Joseph Riverwind and his lovely wife, Dr. Laura Lynn Riverwind, look at the pipe on video and weigh in on it. And that was just last week. And, you know, one of the things about this is that with that kind of a pipe, the lung capacity to make a draw on that pipe is not human. And this pipe was like three times the size of any other Native American pipe in the collection. In fact, as most of these artifacts, the people that owned it didn't know what it was. They knew it was a pipe. They knew it was big, but they didn't put two and two together because they're not looking through that particular paradigm. They're not looking for the Nephilim. They're not really attuned to the Native American legends, which all the tribes in the United States have, but also in your neck of the woods too in New Zealand. The idea of the red-haired giants were there. And there's artifacts all around New Zealand. People, I have never been there, but people have sent me video and photographs and legends and everything else. And I need to do, that's why, one of the reasons why I want to go to New Zealand.
I'll just introduce you to Martin Dutre, bro. He'll show you around. That we've got all sorts of sites and bullhorns and dome houses and ancient walls and this exactly. kind of stuff. So all over the place. And of course, the kind of history that gets taught is just the classic false dichotomy. Here's two incorrect versions of history for you to choose from. It was either this one or this one. Which one was it? Which one was it? You know, for fuck's sake.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the deal. I mean, we go to what's called school, and it's a managed agenda, as Chuck Missler would say. And what I mean by that is everything, the information that we get has been managed, carefully managed. And so scientists make a big deal about looking for truth, but when the truth goes in a direction that they don't want to go in, then it's immediately obfuscated. And we've got evidence of this, which we will reveal. Some of this I'll reveal in the new book. I mean, I can talk about some of it, but we see it over and over and over again, where evidence is deliberately withheld from not only the American people, but really the people of the world have a right to know what our true origins are, where we come from, how we got here, what is going on. We have a right to know. And it's definitely being withheld. And of course, this gets into, I'll wear my tinfoil hat here proudly, but it gets into the whole UFO phenomenon, which I've written, again, extensively about, and been in the field and talked to countless people. I've seen two myself. And the phenomenon is real, burgeoning, and not going away. And it's a question is, what are these craft? Where are they from? What's going on? You know, I've been on Ancient Aliens two seasons, which was interesting. And the reason why we started our own series, the Watchers series, was because we couldn't get a fair shake. What I mean by that, look, it's their show. They can do whatever they want. But when they interview me for 3 hours and I'm cut down to like a 30-second soundbite, it's insulting. And then they twist the words, which they can do. because it's their show and it's their dime. I get that.
This is why, whenever the mainstream media come to interview me, I have a camera running. And whenever and then right after they publish their story, I publish the entire interview.
You got to do it, because otherwise it's like they just take it and cut it up and chop it up, and they make you look like you're saying one thing when you didn't say that at all. So that's why we started the Watchers series, and we're on 10. And frankly, some of what we have in Watchers 10 is absolutely mind-blowing. And we know the blowback from the skeptics and everything else is going to, you know, going to be what it is. And all I have to say is this, Vinny, with all due respect, guys, go out and do your own stinking research. You know, go to Paracas, get some samples, get some hair, do your own DNA testing. You know, I'm so sick of this, where these people sitting around in their mom's basement in their underwear have some blog someplace and just immediately say that the evidence, let's say I found that on Catalina. I went there, Vinny. I went to the museum. There was a cache of records that had been missing for over 50 years. It cost me $1,000 to get access to it. After hours, I spent 10 hours in the archives. I found photographs there, which we've had analyzed, that prove there were 9-footers out in Catalina Island, which is about 26 miles out from Los Angeles, in a chain of islands known as the Channel Islands. I mean, that's hardcore, in-your-face research. There it is. And it's analyzed by 3 different guys on computers who took the photograph, you know, digitized them, manipulated them. They're 9-footers. That's not supposed to be there. So when we went back to the museum to film me in the museum 8 months after I published a book with that information, they had taken my picture, which I had discovered, which was in the archives in a museum box in a manila folder, stashed away, never to see the light of day. But I discovered that picture and I published it, because it's over 100 years old. It's almost 100 years old. 1919 is the date on the photo. So when we got there, the photograph was blown up and put up on the wall of the museum with this long soliloquy underneath it. Okay? Guess what? The giant in the photograph was cropped out of the picture. And I went, we have all this on film. And I went to the curator and said, you know, why'd you guys do this? You know, why? And I showed her the book. This is what the photograph looks like. Why did you crop the photo? And so I also appeared on the History Channel's In Search of the Lost Giants, the season finale with the Vieira brothers, because it's my intellectual property. I'm the guy that actually discovered it. And so they had me on, and it was great. We had a little romp, but then they spun it, the History Channel. Well, they always do that, like you just talked about, and they immediately went to the Darwinian paradigm. And by the way, you know, Darwinism is sacrosanct in both academia and the scientific community. But what's interesting is in the higher echelons of Darwinism, specifically when you get guys like Richard Dawkins, they're looking at what's known as intelligent design. So they realize that this whole thing just didn't happen by chance. The idea of the coding of a genetic system that we have, a DNA, the deoxyribonucleic double helix of life, this incredible information matrix, because that's what it is. And you look at that thing and you just kind of go, oh my gosh, how does this work? And it wasn't discovered till Watson and Crick discovered it, you know, 50, 60 years ago or whatever. The bottom line is, many of the Darwinists are now looking at the whole Darwinian theory and they're saying, wait a minute, it doesn't work. Because DNA, always, 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 when you have 2 hummingbirds, you get hummingbirds when they mate. You don't get a humpback whale. Humpback whales, no matter how many times they mate, for how many thousands of years, will there be like small changes? Sure, there will be. But you're still going to get a humpback whale. And on it goes, because the coding in that DNA system is such that if you screw with it, you get something that you don't want. You get something that's aberrant, that doesn't work at all, and usually dies at a very young age.
And you just imagine it, some kind of poor creature, some kind of chimera just birthed into this world by people tinkering with shit.
Kill me! Kill me!
And that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, they are creating chimeras. No doubt.
Now, it's quite horrific, but I also find it quite funny. Now, I'm wondering as well, when you spend, let's say, 365 days, 24 hours of each of those, spread over a number of years, right, researching one thing that's very specific, in order to prove it with verifiable evidence, how irritating it is to have it, you know, refuted by people who refused to look at it and didn't want to hear it in the first place.
And that's supposedly science. We've had people on from all different paradigms not look at the evidence and attack me, you know, typical ad hominem attacks. And we're used to it. Like, you know, we're big boys here. That's goes with the territory. But it's, for instance, there was one critic who wrote this lengthy article. He called it Nephilim Boneheads, stating that all these skulls in Peru were cradle headboarded, and that the elongation of the skulls had nothing to do with genetics. Well, wait till you see what comes out in Watchers 10 and what we have. We've got an archaeologist. I mean, I'll just spill the beans a little bit. We know that the foramen magnum cannot be moved in a skull, in a normal human skull, and the foramen magnum in many of the elongated skulls in Peru is in a completely different area than a normal human skull. And the foramen magnum is the part of the skull where at the base of the skull, where the actual base of the skull attaches to the spinal column. Now, you can elongate the head, but you can't move the spinal column around. That's fixed. You just can't do it. You know, you can elongate the skull, I get that, but you can't mess around with the foramen magnum. That's just one of the little discoveries that we've made. And look, we go where the science leads us. I mean, science is a quest for truth. It's blind. And we go where the science leads us. For instance, we have red hair from one of the Paracas mummies. We're allowed legally we're allowed to take the hair out, providing it doesn't have any scalp. So we took hair samples from Senior Juan, who passed away about 2 months ago, unfortunately. Senior Juan's museum in Paracas. We were able to take some of the hair out, and we had it DNA tested. And I can't talk about that, but I can get a hint at it. It's in Watchers 10. It's in the new book. And we've had it tested twice. And what we found was absolutely astounding, in our opinion. So we go where the evidence leads. Conversely, there was a skull, very elongated, extremely elongated. And there's no way you can push the frontal plate, which is where our forehead, at a 45-degree angle. There's just no way you can manipulate it. You'll kill the kid. It just can't happen. And this was a huge skull brought up out of Peru. It was in a doctor's collection, this man's grandfather who passed away about 10, 15 years ago. So it probably came up in the 30s or 40s when you could do this kind of stuff. And you know, nobody cared. You can't do that today. But, you know, go back 60, 70 years ago, and that's what people did. They took artifacts from different countries and brought them back, and this was a private collection. We did DNA testing on this. I can tell you this. We did 5 different DNA testings on this one sample. It came back 5 different haplogroups. The geneticist was scratching his head going, it seems like this artifact, whatever it is, would have had 5 different mothers, and we know that can't be. It also tested both male and female. So the only thing we can come up with is maybe this artifact, and I know it sounds grisly, was used in some sort of ritualistic ceremony where blood was poured into it. And this is his words, not mine. He came up with that idea of why we had so many different haplogroups, and it was all over the map. That's just those are his words. That's what he offered as the reason why we were, you know, getting so many different haplogroups.
That's interesting. But while you were speaking, a question kind of started to emerge in my mind. Number one was kind of like off the side, you know, why haven't people heard about this? I know, because, hey, people can't take this kind of thing, right? Because it really, really messes with their mind places. And so whenever you get interviewed, the editor makes an editorial decision. Is this going to fuck with the entire grounding of our audience's belief structure and make them get really zealous and angry at us for basically changing their lives and making them stop believing the nonsense that they were taught? Yeah. Okay, let's cut it from the film. What else do we have to cut in order to meet our parameters? You know? And the other question is, these sites, these artifacts, these discoveries, what of sabotage? Are there any of these sites or artifacts being destroyed in order to prevent people from knowing about them?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tip my hand here and give you a chapter from a new book. There's a cave called the Lovelock Cave. It's out in Lovelock, Nevada. I've interviewed Paiute elders about the cave, and the Paiutes are a Native American tribe, and the Paiutes talk about there was this race of 9-foot red-haired cannibalistic giants with six fingers, okay? That's their oral tradition. So, you know, the white man comes in, the archaeologists, and they completely dismiss all that. But that's their oral tradition. And the oral tradition is that these giants would steal the women, eat the children, this whole kind of deal. And finally, the Paiutes got together and chased all these the remnants of the giants into this one cave. And they piled brush in front of the cave and lit it on fire. When you go into the cave, and I've been there, the roof of the cave is completely black. It was obviously heated. And the geologists, or the archaeologists rather, went into the cave. They've sealed it off. You can no longer go back in there. But there was archaeological digs that were done there. And there's talk about seven-footers being brought out. Here's the deal. A man went into that cave fairly recently, with about 2 years ago. And when you get there, first of all, it's in the middle of nowhere. There's a little walkway. There's a deck, observation deck. There's nothing to see. It's the mouth of a cave. The actual cave has been sealed off by the Bureau of Land Management, the Army Corps of Engineers, whatever. There used to be two wings that went one side and the other. Both of those are completely sealed off, and you can no longer get in there, which is, you know, why would they do that? Anyway, I digress. So the bottom line is, this guy found a large handprint on a wall. And the only way you can get to it is you've got to get off the deck and walk around the cave. And there's no lights there. You've got to bring your own flashlights. And how many people would do that to begin with? And how many people would leave the deck and start going exploring? And the handprint was very large. Well, they had the misfortune of posting it on their Facebook page. By the time I got there about a month later, someone had come in and erased all vestiges of the giant hand. And that giant handprint, Vinny, was two to three times the size of a normal human being. And it's gone. It's not there anymore. It's completely the rock that it was very easy to see, very in your face. You know, there it is, a big handprint. It was erased. It was gone. And, you know, there you go. Why would someone do that? Why would someone at the museum where I discovered the picture of a 9-footer out on Catalina, why would the museum take that picture and crop it so the giant is no longer in the picture? Why would they do that? And then right underneath a copy, a disparaging set of paragraphs just blasting Ralph Glidden. Why would they do that?
Well, I have two working hypotheses. I could just take a stab in the dark and say either A1, that they're a sociopath who doesn't want their lies, and BS that they've been teaching everybody exposed and undermine their credibility and their personality, and they're so freaking narcissistic that they need to destroy anyone who threatens it. Or the other one is they're just so freaking stupid that they don't think about investigating something first before condemning it. And decided, you know what, you know it'd be better than even just condemning it, covering it up altogether so that nobody can accuse us of not looking at it because it's just not there anymore.
Well, I mean, there you go. It's probably a combination of both, depending on, you know, which museum. I mean, look, I've sat down with tenured archaeologists and anthropologists, and I had one anthropologist, I'll never forget it. He leaned forward to me after grilling me for an hour, and then he told me he knew of where a 30-inch long human femur bone was that had come out of a construction site in Los Angeles. 30-inch human femur bone. I go, let's go. He goes, no, you don't understand. I'm going to rewrite American history. I go, yeah, I know. Let's go. Of course, he wouldn't go because it would ruin his career. Because you can't do that, Vinny. You can't go up against the powers that be. And I'll just move into the political realm here. That's why they'll never allow Donald Trump to get the nomination here, because he's an outsider and he's going to clean house if he gets in there, because the whole system here is completely corrupt.
You know, we're thinking about this entire corruption problem, and I think it's systemic. It actually seems to have taken over nearly every field and institution, hasn't it? Think about it. What field of research or institution of our time hasn't been corrupted?
I rest my case. We're in a fucking bad situation. and it's just about chipping away, right?
Yeah.
Just chip away at them, okay? For goodness sake, you know, what else have you got? Have you got something better to do than reverse the corruption that's taken over the entirety of the human race's development and future? You know, you got something better to do? So you got bigger priorities, bro, you know? I'm talking about the audience, of course.
We're definitely headed towards something. We're headed towards a one world government where the elites, the 1%, are trying to rule us. I mean, what's happening in our country is unprecedented. We are at, I would say, a fever pitch where we could see civil war literally happening in this country at some point because people are fed up with it and they know it. They know we've been lied to. People are waking up and they know it's not business as usual. They know that the last 16 years has been an absolute disaster. It doesn't matter who we vote in, it's business as usual. There's a shadow government which runs this country, and everybody is starting, well, not everybody, many people are waking up to the fact that this is what's going on and they're tired of it. And that's why Trump is resonating with many Americans in this country. I mean, he's bombastic. He's over the top. I get all that. But he resonates. He's talking about building the wall. Interestingly enough, there's an acquaintance who lives in China, and he married a Chinese woman, and he's trying to get her into the country. And, of course, to get her into the country, she's got degrees. She's well-educated, the whole deal. I mean, the woman is, like, you know, really smart. But we'll let 300,000 refugees, which we haven't vetted, which we have no idea of who these people are, into our country from a Middle Eastern country, specifically in Syria, and she can't get in. But we'll let the 300,000 in. I mean, this is how upside down and wacky everything is in this country. It's crazy, which is why I want to move to New Zealand.
Yeah. Well, here in New Zealand, we have X amount of maybe 4 million people, and out of that 4 million people, we bring in about 50,000 immigrants per year. Whereas Finland, for example, has 14 million and they let in 5,000 immigrants a year.
Wow.
You know, so it's an interesting dynamic, this, because what happens is as soon as you start putting fluoride in the water and the chemtrails in the air, by the way, we've got all these things too, but you'll come to New Zealand and you'll go, oh my God, it's the exact same thing as was going on back home, except it's got a different accent or a different look or a different vibe or a different three-letter agency that does the exact same thing here that it does over there. Oh my God, it's a system. Right.
So what you're telling me is you've got the chemtrails there too?
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's disgusting.
You got chemtrails? You got government pushing vaccines on you? Yeah, we got that too. You got whole bunches of real nasty people taking people's land off them and things like that and putting it under government control and saying that nobody else can build nothing else there? Yeah, we got that too. We got pretty much everything that you got, but it's just a smaller scale because it's a smaller slice of hell.
Wow, demoralizing.
Like I say, don't worry, it's just the end of the world. Oh God, I kill me. I do, because this.
Oh, it is. I mean, look, I totally agree with you. I mean, this is, we are heading to what I call a cosmic regime change, and there are forces, supernatural forces, which is the other thing I deal with. But there are supernatural forces which have been in control of this planet for eons, for millennia. And I think that regime change is going to happen, hopefully in our lifetime, because it can't go on too much longer like this. I mean, it is out of control. And I think most people realize just how out of control it really is.
Well, let's just go back to, you know, how your discoveries and whatnot have really changed your worldview, because When you grow up, however you did, and whichever way that you did, you grow up and you get a certain worldview right in front of you, and you can't escape it. However, when you are an honest person, more to the point, honest with yourself, and very few people are, because they think that they would never lie to themselves. Like, I wouldn't lie to me. Yes, you would. Yes, you would. In fact, you're probably doing it right now. But when your worldview changes, you often get trepidatious about how you explain what your new worldview is to other people. So, you know, we all understand the general mainstream view of history about the evolution and what have you. But if there's an alternate history, what your research has actually led you to, regardless of the evidence, what's the story of it?
Well, what's happened is, and this is what we've, which I write about and talk about incessantly, we have been visited in the far distant past by someone with incredible technology. Technology that even in modernity, we would be hard-pressed to duplicate. For instance, when you go to Sacsayhuaman, which is in Peru, about 10, 12,000 feet above sea level, and this huge rock wall. When I say rock, it's really, it's andesite, very hard. It's about 7 on a Mohs hardness scale, 10 being a diamond. So it gives you an idea just how hard this rock is. And the quarry is like 40 miles away, about 2,000 feet lower, and there's no beast of burdens. And the stones that are put there are 110 tons or 120 tons or more. And it's been there for thousands of years. And even the Inca, when the conquistadors come up, and the conquistadors say, well, who built this? They say, we don't know. The giants built them. It was here when we got here. And when you look at this wall in Sacsayhuaman, these huge, huge rocks, I mean, they're megalithic. Like I said, 100 tons, 40 tons, 50 tons. They're polygonal shapes. Each shape, they're not square, they're polygonal. And each shape is completely different. There's no two stones alike. And yet they fit absolutely perfectly. And I've shown photographs to the engineers, to architects, and basically said, okay, can we do this today? And they look at me and laugh nervously because they've been presented with something that's outside their paradigm. That they have no, it's cognitive dissonance. They have nothing to relate to. So they look at this and they go, when was this done? And I say, well, it was at least done in the Neolithic 3,500 years ago, perhaps much older. And if it's older than the Neolithic, which we have got copper chisels or whatever, if it moves into the Bronze Age, well, that's fine too. You still can't cut andesite with a copper chisel. You just can't do it. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work in this nice little historical progression that we're taught in school. Places like Sacsayhuaman that I just talked about, or Ollantaytambo, also in Peru, or places that we see in Bolivia like Pumapunku and Tiwanaku. When I've been to these places, it doesn't fit the historical paradigm. There's an outside agency that is not only constructing these edifices, which, by the way, are all over the planet, but they are also, in my opinion, manipulating the human genome. And interestingly enough, there are passages in ancient prophetic texts which talk about all this.
So after the visitors came with their advanced technology, what did they do? How did they set everything up, you know?
That's a really good question, and no one has an answer to that.
Not an answer, but speculate.
Well, in my opinion, they left in the same way that they came. And then we see the same type of thing happen later. In other words, many of the sites that I just talked about, Tiwanaku in Bolivia, Pumapunku in Bolivia, Ollantaytambo in Peru, Sacsayhuaman in Peru, I would put them very old. They're pre-flood. They were destroyed, in my opinion, by a global disaster, a global flood, which every culture on the planet talks about. Every culture on the planet.
At least 182 of them, including ancient Maori oral tradition as well.
Exactly. They all talk about some kind of flood and animals in a boat and a guy and the whole deal. Okay.
So, and they found the boat in the Ararat Ranges near Syria, I think, or near Turkey.
Yeah, and that's debatable. People have talked about that. I've been on that trail for quite some time. It's very slippery, very slippery. But those sites that I just mentioned are pre-flood. After the flood, the same type of structures show up, but they're different. The building is different. In Ohio, you've got what's called the Great Circle Mound. They don't build with rock. It's not megalithic. It's an earthwork. But the earthwork and the whole complex, which I've been to many, many times now, is mind-boggling. because Native Americans didn't build like this. They didn't make structures like this. And all of these places that we see evidence of human sacrifice. When you go to a place, Teotihuacan in Mexico, again, this is well after the flood. It's a fairly recent structure, okay, depending on who you talk to. It's a fairly recent structure. And when you're there, when I was there, I was taken aback by the enormity of the complex. It's not built with megalithic stones. It's built with some sort of a cement and indigenous rock. But the geometry, the knowledge of precession, the advanced mathematics, the building techniques, the engineering, all come into play. And it rises up from nowhere, Vinny. There's no pre-existing culture. Likewise, when you go 5,000 years ago, once again in Peru, 3 hours north of Lima, there's a site called Corral. And every place I've been talking about, I've been to. I've walked. I've felt the wind in my face, smelled the air, looked at the remains, picked up the dirt in my fingers, you know, walked around, felt everything. I mean, as much as I possibly could. And in Corral, it's the oldest city in the Americas, both North, Central, and South America. And when you're in Corral, it reminded me instantly of Teotihuacan in Mexico. But Teotihuacan in Mexico is thousands of years after Corral. And when I was there, I asked the guide, I said, this reminds me exactly, because it's all pyramids, Vinny. It's all pyramids. And there's no pre-existing culture. And why the pyramidal shape? What the heck is that doing there? There's no pre-existing culture. They're not messing with shapes. The whole stinking complex rises up all at once from nothing. You know, from absolutely nothing. Again, advanced engineering, advanced building techniques, knowledge of the precession, knowledge of the equinoxes, the solstices. I mean, it's all there. And human sacrifice is done. Once again, in my opinion, there's an outside intelligence coming with all this information, and they are revered as gods. They are looked upon as gods, and they build these sites. Later on, the sites are destroyed, abandoned, something happens, and we don't know what happens to many of these sites. We don't know why Corral collapsed. We don't know really why Teotihuacan was abandoned. There's lots of theories, but we really don't know. We don't know why the Great Circle Mountain in Ohio, which I talked about, was abandoned. When the Native Americans got there, it was all intact. They didn't build it. When the white men show up, they go, well, where did this come from? The Native Americans go, we don't know. It was here when we got here. So this is what we're up against. There's like Scotty Walters, who's a friend of mine. I've met him a couple of times. We talk from time to time. When I say friend, an acquaintance, I should say. But, you know, we share information from time to time, and our paths do cross over. And, Scotty always says that the history we've been taught is all wrong. And he's right. I completely agree with him. The history that most people know is a joke. It's nonsensical. I mean, for Zawi Hawass, let me just finish up with this little rant. For Zawi Hawass, who's an incredible man in some respects, first of all, he can read hieroglyphics and I can't. So right away, you know, the guy's amazing, okay? And he's been all over Egypt. He's done some amazing work, amazing discovery. I mean, my hat's off to the guy. He's in the field. And he's a proud Egyptian. Bully for Zawi. However, where Zawi and I part company is Zawi insists that the Great Pyramid of Cheops was built by the Egyptians. And here's my challenge to Mr. Hawass, with all due respect. Above the king's chamber, which is about two-thirds of the way up the pyramid, and the pyramid's very tall, and above the king's chamber are solid granite blocks the size of railroad cars, which create the roof to the king's chamber. And above those granite blocks are a series of corbels which then deflect the weight from the rest of the pyramid from collapsing the king's chamber. Here's the riddle. With all due respect, Zawi, show me how those granite blocks were quarried from Aswan, because that's where they came from. They're not indigenous to the Giza Plateau. They come from Aswan, 500 miles away. How do you take a granite block in the Neolithic and cut it with a copper saw? Answer, you can't. And how do you move it? And how do you place it? And that's the conundrum. It really is. And Egyptologists, there is no answer to it. Well, they must have done it because it's there. No, that's not going to fly. We know it's there. But to say that they must have done it, you're just making this stuff up. because all you've got is copper chisels and copper saws, and it will not cut granite. I don't care how much sand you put in the thing, it's not going to cut the granite block. And then how do you move the granite block? And then how do you place the granite block? It's, we're looking at another technology. And what's interesting is we never knew, we used to assume that the pyramid was a four-sided structure. It's not, it's an eight-sided structure. And at the center of each of the sides, the pyramid actually buckles in. Now, this thing, this structure, is absolutely a smoking gun, that the technology used to build it has been lost to us, completely lost to us. We have no idea who built it, when it was built. I put the pyramid pre-flood. It's pre-flood. That's
right. I was just thinking now the Hutchison effect could actually explain a lot of those questions that you posed. You know what that is?
The levitation, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a food show, I think, one time. This chick was going down down an Egyptian river with an Egyptian fisherman. And she says, she asks him, so how did you guys build the pyramids? And he goes, well, they would tap the massive stone with a wand and just float it through the air and just walk it along the river and then plop it on the pyramid. And she's like,
what?
Sure. You know,
but that's, look, that's what we honestly think. I mean, we really do. We think that levitation was used. So, you know, when you say that, I'm right there with you. I mean, I believe it was levitation.
And that's all that, for those who don't know who John Hutchison is, you know, there's a really nice little bit of Google video watching that'll really fuck your mind up. This dude can make objects levitate and fly up and down. He could make I actually met a guy who was with John Hutchison out in the desert one time when he was performing a little demonstration for people. He had, I think, a machete, and the machete rose up into midair and then turned white hot and then separated into three parts and then came back together and then dropped on the ground in one piece, and then John picked it up right away, even though and it was cool to the touch.
Wow.
Yeah, so when people say we don't have the technology to do this today, I'm always of three minds about things. There's the mainstream way of thinking about it, the real wacky, crazy way of thinking about it, and then there's the real wacky, realistic way of thinking about it, which tends to be true a lot of the time. You know, if John Hutchison were given a budget and a whole bunch of engineers with skills, etc., they could probably build a pyramid.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? I mean, I've gone to, there's another site, which is in Bolivia, and it's called Solistani. And I was there my last trip down, and I'm getting the wanderlust again. There's places I really want to see, but I digress. But we were there in Solistani, and these towers are thousands of years old. They are made of basalt, very hard to cut, and they are circular, which in itself is a feat, okay? And anything, squares are easy. There's a moment you start shaping stone in a circle, it's like, oh my gosh, but wait, it gets better. It's conical. It's like an ice cream cone. It's narrower at the bottom and larger at the top, which means that every millimeter, I'll use the particular instead of inches, but every millimeter you go up, the radius changes. Every millimeter you go up, the radius changes. And these towers, Vinny, are absolutely perfect. They are perfect. And when you go to the site, it looks like something cataclysmic happened, like some explosion. There's violence there because these things that were just blown out. They're just like the backside is just blown out of these things. And the rocks have been hollowed out, which are placed, and these were towers. And so, of course, the archaeologists say, oh, they're funerary towers. Nonsense. Nothing to do with funerary towers at all, period. They were something else. Part of a grid system, which I think covered the planet at one point in time. And I've had electrical engineers look at the Solistani towers and go, this looks like a capacitor. Because basalt has piezoelectric property, which can conduct electricity. When we were there, Chase Klotsky, who was a UFO investigator, she had this vest and a belt on with all these like recording devices and all this. Everything was battery operated. The moment she walked in to the center of a circle, the tower was gone, but the foundation was still there on this one. They're like, they're all over the landscape. Some of them are intact. There's a couple of them which are have never been toppled over. Many of them are destroyed. Some of them have been completely cleared away except the foundation. So on the way up the trail, this is one of the first ones we saw, and she walked into the middle of this thing. All of the batteries were drained instantly. She couldn't believe it. She went down to the car. About 45 minutes, she returned. Everything's loaded up again. And I go, are you going to go back in there? And she goes, yeah, I got to see what happens. She walks in, same thing, all the batteries drained. So there's something going on there. And, you know, the archaeologist, oh, these were funerary towers used by nonsense. You guys have no idea. You're making this stuff up. You're just making it up. You have no idea who built it, how they built it, where the basalt comes from. You know, I mean, do it in modernity. Just show me. Just build one of these things in modernity. How long would it take? And you've got diamond sauce. One more thing. There's an artifact that I found in North Carolina a couple of weeks ago when I was there at a conference speaking. The guy comes up. It's the same place where we, the same guys who had the big, huge pipe, okay? He comes up with this jade axe, ceremonial. But it's life size. It's utilitarian. You could use it to go out into the woods. And it's absolutely a thing of beauty. I mean, it's just magnificently done. It's a piece of art. It's just gorgeous. It is worth, I mean, I don't know. Look, I'm not an appraiser, but it's got to be worth thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. Priceless. And it came out of Teotihuacan years and years and years ago. And, of course, no one knows the provenance because that's all done on the black market. So here I am holding this piece of jade, and I'm in this. I'm in the store. It's called Rings and Things, and this, it's a group of family jewelers. They've been, you know, working in diamonds and silver and gold and everything else for generations, family-owned business. And they're also collectors. And I look at this guy, and I said, okay, can you make this today? And he looked at me nervously and said, well, you know, we've got diamond saws and this and that. It'd be very difficult to make, but yeah, we could do it. Now, go back 1,000 years. How did they make that? It's out of one solid piece of jade. And it's probably 14, 16 inches high by about a foot across. The handle is exquisitely carved. And where the head attaches, it's all one piece. The head attaches, and it's just, it's absolutely perfect.
Well,
beautiful artifact.
One of the theories is that you can, if you put a static field on matter, you can program that matter, or you can program how you want the particles to either repel each other or simply stay together. I'm just thinking about this kind of high-tech world that used to be. Let's think they had a global tech grid. That's what the pyramids all are. There's some way of sending energy from one part to the other. They also had advanced healing technology, I think. They could live for a very long time. They had global trade. They had a one-world society, I think.
I concur.
We understand that that society got wiped out, and there's megalithic sites all over the world to prove that it was indeed global society. So did the visitors come, build this global society, watch it burn, and then leave? Or what?
Well, here's my take on it. And I'm stuck with it. And this is after 36 years of research, okay? We are in the midst of a cosmic war. The cosmic war has been raging for who knows how long. I would say millennia. There are two sides of the war. What was wiped out, these ancient megalithic structures that were there, they were wiped out deliberately. And we hear about that in the biblical prophetic narrative, which talks about the Noah flood. But we also hear about it in other legends all over the globe. So there was some sort of a cataclysmic event which wiped this thing out. And you talk about this, the chemtrails and the one world government and the elites and everything else and the fluoride in the water. There is a shadow government. There is a dark agenda. There are those who have given themselves over to what I would call the dark side. The good news is all this is in the biblical prophetic narrative, which talks about exactly this war that's been going on. And at some point, the tables will be turned. We are in the period of time where I believe we're going to see a regime change, a cosmic regime change. Basically, where the good guys literally come riding in on white horses, literally flying white horses at that. And I know that that sounds incredibly bizarre, but look, people got to understand that the supernatural is real. When you look at, and I'll digress here, but I'll bring it back. When we look at the craft, and the craft, the UFO craft, which continues to materialize with impunity over every nation on this globe, the fastest planes that we have can't keep up with them. They defy our known laws of physics, just like in an abduction phenomenon where someone is taken and they are floated through the wall. That you can't do that. That's beyond our physics, but it's not beyond their physics. They know how to do that. So to us, it's supernatural, and it is, but to them, it's natural. It's what they're able to do. They can manipulate time, space, matter, and energy in ways that we can't. So to us, it seems miraculous, and it is from our perspective. To them, it's just what they do. They manipulate time, space, matter, and energy. We see this through the abduction phenomena with the whole UFO phenomenon, where the craft will jump through space, where people have missing time, where they're floated through walls or windows or ceilings, whatever, where they have missing time, where they're down a road, and then 4 hours later they're going the opposite direction, 200 miles away. How is that possible? In a car and they're driving? I mean, you know, come on. It's crazy, crazy stuff. So we're being visited. And the question is, how do we know who's benevolent and who's malevolent? Because it's crazy what's going on. And what I point to is the prophecies that are there in these ancient prophetic texts, because someone is outside space-time as we know it and is calling out with great specificity these prophecies, writing them down, putting them in a book, and, you know, a 13-year-old can read them and understand what they mean. Now, there it is. It's all in black and white, and it's there, that prophetic narrative which goes through all these ancient prophetic texts. And that's what I kind of hang my hat on, hang my intellectual hat, hang my spiritual hat on that, because it makes the most sense, because these prophecies have been fulfilled in the past, and many of them are being fulfilled even as we speak.
Usually in cases like this, if it's going to be the end of the world or the rise of something new and much better, you've heard of Occam's razor, when one's real.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, simplest explanations are usually the correct one. I don't think so. I think I use Occam's razor because it means if there's one option that sounds really rosy and simple and it's easy to understand and makes you feel better about life, that's the lie. And the one that makes you feel really terrified and really unsure of yourself and makes you start questioning the entire way you start looking at the entire fucking world and yourself, that's the one that's unfortunately true.
Yeah, I'm leaning. You know, the Occam's razor thing has been used so much. I agree. It oversimplifies everything. What we're looking at is something that's so complex and has been going on for thousands of years. And Occam's razor just isn't going to cut it. I concur.
Thank you very much. And we will see you again after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Just remember, this is a listener-supported show. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and start donating monthly today. And also, this is a listener-supported network. So go to americanfreedomradio.com/donate.html and flick them a couple of dollars of that legal tender that they can't refuse. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the smoothest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with me, your host, Vinnie. I'm incredibly smooth count. And my very special guest is, oh my God, L.A. Moselli, right? And almost forgot that for a second there. That would have been incredibly embarrassing and unprofessional, so that would have fit right in with the show. We were getting into the discussion of the Nephilim in this ancient culture, because I thought about this for quite a bit. Now, if you came across the stars or whatever, there'd be two reasons for it. Number one, you're either a refugee home planet being destroyed or something like that, and you're fleeing here, but you find out that the local natives are just really, really easy to conquer and quite stupid, really. So you can just tell them anything and get them to build whatever you want. You build your own new utopia. You rule the entire world. You go out to extravagance and excess, and all you want is really power and greed and hurt and pain and sex. And essentially, that's because there's nothing to challenge you. There's nothing to make you afraid or whatever until one day, unfortunately, everything gets wiped out. Everything you built over that period of time is gone. Second scenario, it's conquest. They wanted something. What do they want? Don't know.
I think they want to be worshipped, Vinny. That's because all these complexes I've been to, there's always a seat of worship and there's always human sacrifice. They want to be worshipped. They also want to breed with us. They want to create a hybrid being. And interestingly enough, Graham Hancock, he's down in, I think, Bolivia. He's doing all this ayahuasca. He's just like, I don't know, 30, 40 ayahuasca things. It's like, oh my gosh, how do you come back? Anyway, so he's doing all this stuff and he writes the book Supernatural. And at the end of the book, and he talks about, you know, what he's feeling, what he's thinking, what he's seeing and everything else. And he's wrestling with it and he's trying to come up with an answer. And at the end of the book, he just says, as crazy as it seems, these entities, wherever they're from, whoever they are, they seem obsessed with creating a hybrid with us. They want to have sex, mate with us, and create a hybrid. And what's interesting, it goes back into these ancient prophetic texts where we read about the Nephilim, where these fallen angelic beings saw the women, had sex with the women, created this hybrid race known as the Nephilim, populated the earth. This is the reason for the flood. What's interesting to me is in the Americas, let me back up. There's this one ancient text, and it says, the seed of the serpent will be at war with the seed of the woman. That's pretty cryptic. The seed of the serpent will be at war with the seed of the woman. Well, okay, what does that mean? And apparently, according to these ancient prophetic texts, that the seed of the woman eventually becomes, in the Judeo-Christian worldview, the Messiah. What's interesting enough, and I wrote a paper on this, it's actually in my new book, Nephilim Hybrids. There's a site in Ohio called the Great Serpent Mound. I've been there. Very weird site. Native Americans didn't build this thing. Again, the undulations of this huge serpent point to the rise of the moon, the solstices, the equinox. So once again, there's engineering, there's mathematics, there's building techniques, which the thing has never eroded in thousands and thousands of years, literally. So how does that work, right? And there it is. But the whole purpose of this thing is the serpent's mouth is a gape, wide open, the maw. And from that, in front of it, is an egg. Everyone says, yeah, it's an egg. And so one interpretation, the interpretation which is held, is the serpent is giving birth. The egg is symbolic of the world. The serpent denotes wisdom. Well, when I went there, and this was actually a friend of mine sort of said, what if it's this? And that's why I wrote the paper. He's the guy that had sort of had the cosmic download. I just did the grunt work of writing the paper. But it's a different paradigm. What if it ties back into this ancient prophetic text, which says the seed of the serpent will be at enmity with the seed of the woman? What if the serpent in Ohio is attempting to swallow the seed of the woman? That's a whole different take. No one's ever thought of that before. Completely different paradigm. Completely different way of looking at the serpent mound. And I wrote the article. It was already published, but it'll come out in the new book. But that's...
Well, let's think about like the concept of the psychopath and the use of the reptilian brain, that lack of creativity, that inability to feel empathy, those kind of things. And then you whip it back here. Let's say these alien beings who don't have those kind of things, they're essentially right. Psychopaths incarnate, come here and then they see us and then they become jealous of all our creativity and all our gifts and everything. And then they want to become hybrids with us so that they can be more powerful than us and include all of our gifts as well as their own.
Well, I mean, that's certainly one way of looking at it, and I think that's not too far off the mark, quite frankly. I think that's a very, very good way of looking at it. And, you know, you mentioned reptilian. I think their true form, I think they can shapeshift into anything that they want, but I think their true form is reptilian. Let me tell you a story, which is chilling, absolutely chilling. And this just came across my desk basically 10 days ago, maybe not even that far. And we actually did a show on ppsreport.com about it, which is very unnerving. There's a friend of mine who's got a church down in near Oceanside. And he's out there. I've been to the church, neat little place. He's a really cool guy. They kind of work with a lot of the vets coming back who were shell-shocked. So it's really a cool place. Anyway, one night, there's a guy out there. He's about 6'8", real big, tall guy. And he's well-dressed, doesn't smell like alcohol. He's not like a drug addict. He's not homeless. And he wants to engage my friend. And, you know, my friend will not walk out of the building. For whatever reason, he's standing on the in the doorway of the church. And this guy keeps trying to get him out of the building. And he keeps asking, well, can I touch you? Really crazy stuff. And they're dialoguing, and this guy starts quoting scripture to him out of the blue. And it's like my friend's going like, well, what's going on here? And what was unnerving was this guy, there was a moment where he stopped talking, this 6'8" guy. He stopped talking and stared at my friend, okay? And this is why he called me at 10 o'clock at night. His eyes shifted, okay? His eyes shifted to the right, and in place were a set of reptilian eyes. And my friend stared at them for 4 seconds. Then they shifted back, and they just looked at each other in silence. And then the guy goes, I roam, his words, the direct quote, I roam from here to Los Angeles. I have to go now because there's a church I have to go see. And the guy left, but not before touching his arm. And when he touched his arm, my friend said it was like something came in. And that night he went back home and he was feeling nauseous and sick. And he immediately took authority over it. And we did the same thing on the next morning and drove it out. So this is where the story gets even more bizarre. The following day, 2 days later, he and one of the guys that are down there with him are walking around the grounds, okay? And they're praying against, you know, type of demonic stuff. They're praying against it. It's called a prayer walk. That's what they're doing. Nothing religious about it. It's spiritual warfare 101, where you're going in there and you're claiming the territory and you're laying down stuff and, you know, bad stuff can't come over this line type of thing. So as they turn the corner, he sent me pictures of this. There's a wall which is 8'6" above where he is. Perched on the wall is what looks like a child, but the child's face is weird. It doesn't look right. He doesn't look right. The child's out of place. His chin, his face comes down to a point. There's like not a chin like we have. It comes to a point. The child, which about they estimated about 10 years old, is what he looked like, jumps off the wall in front of them. So a 10-year-old child jumps off an 8.5-foot wall. Excuse me. Yeah, something. What's wrong with this picture? And lands about 4 feet from my friend. Both of these guys see this. The child's eyes are 100% black. There are no whites. He's a black-eyed kid. The child then bounds up the stairs. They follow it. When they get up to the top of the stairs, child's gone. There's no place for him to go, Vinny. It's a 50-foot blind alley. No place for him to go. He's got to run the 50 feet to get to the street. There's no way he could have done that. No way. They followed him up. They got to the top of the stairs. The kid was gone, completely just vanished from sight. So those are two very troubling instances that, you know, for me, it's firsthand information. It's not, hey, a friend of mine, this is like right from the horse's mouth. You're getting it secondhand. I got it firsthand. And that's the type of stuff that's beginning to manifest, which, of course, is supernatural. And these guys are not benevolent at all. In both instances, these guys are are from the dark side, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I think the psychopath kind of analogy, if you have a look at the descriptions of the behaviors of, you know, the gods and the serpents and so on and so forth, and then you have a look at psychopathy and modern psychology, and even, what was it, the Archons, and what were they called, the Gnostic teachings, right? It's the same MO, right? These are things that are separated thousands of years apart, but the exact same character attributes, that obsession with hierarchy, the obsession with wanting to be worshipped and what have you, it seems to me that these are very evolved beings that are capable of possessing human beings as hosts, need to feed on negative energy. That's why they cause suffering and pain, because they actually need to feed off of it. And in order to conceal themselves throughout history, they occasionally burn down what they built and attach themselves to a new host and then start all over again so that they can live forever, perpetually building slave societies to worship themselves.
I agree. We're on the same page. That's exactly what I think is going on. What you just said is exactly what I think is going on. But I think that we're in a period of time where the good guys are going to come in and clean house. That's what I'm putting my faith in at the moment.
For me, I kind of like threw faith out the window and I go, what does it matter, right? I was just thinking about this, right? It's the end of the world, it's the end of times, whether or not there's a savior or not. I don't think it actually really matters what the outcome is. What matters is what we do right now in order to facilitate it, right? Because I think in order to make a road anywhere, you're going to have to go through some really hard punishment so that the way for others is easier. And if it falls on you to be the one that's building that road, whether that be a road of understanding, a road of knowledge, a road of science, a road of tolerance, you'll be the one that has to suffer through it so that others don't have to. And even when the day the world comes, when everything that you wish comes into being, there won't actually be a place for you there.
Well, you know, we're going to have to wait and see just where how it all plays out. You know, I look at the ancient prophetic texts, and in my opinion, I think that we're in the midst of a cosmic regime change.
Let's talk about these, because you've referred to ancient prophetic texts a number of times, but let's go through a number of them. I mean, which ones in particular have kind of got you on in the frame of mind that where there is going to be a cosmic power shift in the near future?
Well, the one I specifically look at is the Judeo-Christian prophetic narrative, which is all through from Genesis to Revelation. And unfortunately, much of this has been maligned over the years. And what I mean by that, there are many of the churches that never even tell people about the prophetic narrative that's in their own book. And so they have literally a form of religion, but deny its power. And the people don't know the prophecies in their own book. And yet they'll be there for 50 years, right from cradle to grave. And they'll have no idea what's written there. And what amazes me about these ancient prophetic texts is the specificity of them, where they will point to, it's not like Nostradamus, which with the fuzzy quatrains, which can, well, it can mean this, it can mean that. Yeah, there's some prophecies like that. I get that. But most of these are very, very, very specific. One of the ones we are all looking at and wondering if we're in the season where that will happen, there's a prophet lived about, 2,500 years ago. The guy's name was Isaiah. And he wrote this prophecy. And the prophecy says, Damascus has become a ruinous heap. Now, that's never happened. Damascus is the oldest inhabited city on the planet. It's thousands and thousands of years old. It's never become a ruinous heap. And what we are looking at, and I show this at my conferences, I've got drone footage of the surrounding area. It looks like Berlin in 1945. It is absolutely a ruinous heap. And of course, this is why the millions of refugees are fleeing the country. The surrounding area to Damascus is utterly destroyed. And parts of Damascus are utterly destroyed. But the city, I guess the center of the city, is still intact. So are we looking at a slow fulfillment of that prophecy? We just don't know. But surely we're in a window of time where we at least have to look at that and take note, because something's going on there, and it's never happened like that before. And it's not over. That's the problem. I mean, well, L.A., just calm down. It's not over. Bashar al-Assad still is in power. The Russians are still in the Middle East. ISIS is still rampaging all over the area. So it's a very, very complex, back to Occam's razor again, right? The simplest answer, nonsense. A very, very complex landscape over there. But that's just one of the prophecies which I track with and look for, that's thousands of years old. And is that it's sort of happening right in front of our eyes, not conclusive, can't chalk it off yet as being fulfilled, but something's going on there. So that's why I look at all this stuff. There's another one. And right where you guys are and right where I am, I'm in Los Angeles, you're in New Zealand. The earth is shaking like never before. There's one prophecy that says there'll be earthquake in diverse places. The problem with this prophecy is it's written to almost 2,000 years ago. And Vinny, you and I both know that there's no way to track an earthquake 2,000 years ago. If there was an earthquake in L.A., and you're in New Zealand, how are you going to know about it? You're not going to know about it.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Wait for the dude with his mail like about 6 months later. Hey, bro, we had an earthquake six months ago.
Exactly.
I'll add that to the records, bro.
So here we are in modernity where my iPhone pings anything over a 6.0. And that, you know, the whole world's looking at this thing going, oh, my gosh, rise of the earthquakes, rise of the volcanic activity. Well, we look at that. When I say we, there's a group of us who track this stuff and write about it and talk about it. We feel that we're in the window of time where many of these prophecies are coming to pass. Certainly, I mean, the rise of a 9.0 earthquake, which is unprecedented. The ones that have, what was it, down in 7.4 in Ecuador? The Ring of Fire is really heating up. I'm concerned because Los Angeles, where I am, I'm outside of L.A., an hour outside of L.A., but that no matter. When the Northridge quake happened, everything shook here. And we're overdue. We're really overdue here. And what's troubling about this is when we look at Fukushima with the 9.0, that shook and devastated the Fukushima prefecture. And it also destroyed much of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactor. Well, 5 years after the fact, we find out now, and most people don't know this because it's not, once again, the lamestream media never tells anybody any of this stuff. But the nuclear fuel rods, okay, in reactor 4 have gone missing. They don't know where they are, Vinny. They have no idea where they are. In other words, they have melted through the containment. They're gone, and no one knows where they are. And they send in robots to try to find them. The trouble is it's so hot in there that the wiring melts and the robot goes dead. That's where we are. And I find that incredibly troubling. How much radioactivity is leaking into the Pacific? There's no way to tell, and we can't get a straight answer.
Well, that's the troubling thing, isn't it? What was it? There were two instances that made me go, okay, I need to quit my job. And then the other instance was, okay, I need to quit my part-time job. You know, the first instance was the oil Kano incident, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico and all that stuff started popping up. And I'm okay, this is a world-changing event. I've got to quit my job. And I did. But then I got a part-time job. And then Fukushima happened. It goes, okay, now I've got to quit the part-time job. Okay, now full-time doing all of this sort of thing. As big events like that and people's reactions to them that I think are really inspiring. Because in adversity, that's when people shine. Most people don't experience a lot of adversity. They think adversity is taking an Adderall when you go to a university, right? That's not what it is. It's not what it is. All right. Like, who was it? I think it was Dean Clifford who told me about Biodome. The problem with Biodome, an enclosed system is that as the trees inside it grew, although they had all the water that they needed, all the sunlight that they needed, all the oxygen and everything, as they got to a certain point, they would break under their own weight.
Huh.
Why? No wind. Nothing for them to resist.
Mm.
Right? It's in resisting the challenges that face you throughout life that make you strong. And I think what has happened in society is that people have attempted purposefully to live their life in the pursuit of happiness, not knowing that it's through suffering that happiness can truly be achieved.
Very well said. That's actually very philosophical, and I concur. Pain is always the teacher, always the teacher. And we can react to pain in two different ways. We can medicate it or we can embrace it. What I mean by that is, and that's why many people are medicated on the planet today and take drugs so they don't have to deal with the pain, or they'll spend hours and hours and hours year after year going to psychotherapy or whatever to try to get rid of the pain, or they'll find the source of the pain. And it always comes back to two things. One, the first is forgiveness. When we forgive those who have hurt us, it sets us free. We actually have the key to our own prison. And of course, the second thing, which trumps everything, is love. When we reach out in love to those around us and who have hurt us, that blows people away. You can't argue with that. It supersedes everything. Love is the greatest calling. But I agree. Pain is always the teacher. And look, I mean,
I was having a conversation with my neighbor the other day about this exact thing, bro. His wife and me and one of the other people around the house down where we live get up at like near on 5 o'clock in the morning, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, they have to go get in traffic and that kind of thing, and they really hate it. And I said, well, if you really, really hate it, just remember that pain is there to teach you something. And if you keep hurting, but you're not learning anything, it's time to change your freaking life, son.
Bingo. And I agree. I mean, it's like we have a saying in some of the circles I travel in that, you know, I didn't get it this time. I got to take another lap around the mountain. There are just lessons that we learn through life, and then we think we've got them, only to circle back and see that there's just the first layer of the onion.
Yeah. Speaking of the layer of the onion. What was that? It was totally spooky. But anyway, I found this, what was that film? The Nine Gates with Johnny Depp. The realization had nothing to do with the film, but it had to do with about waking up to things and then waking up again and then waking up again and again and again and again and again and realizing that there are infinite lies to wake up from. And you might never actually wake up to them all. That was a thought that really kind of scared me, that I won't know all the truth. Like, ever shot at knowing all of it. So what we do instead when people come to that realization is they try to specialize. They go, okay, I can get to the truth of this one thing, at least, you know, I'll dedicate my life to that. Then you help others come to that truth as well, and you incorporate it by listening to all the other people who have been the specialist, and then boom, you become a generalist, and you know the way things are, but you don't know why, because you haven't taken the time to look into it. You see? That's what happens. Everybody thinks that they know that the way things are, but they don't, because they have no idea why it is the way that it is. That means they don't know how it actually works.
Well, unless I think, in my opinion, Vinny, unless the person understands that we're involved in a cosmic war and that there are forces, supernatural forces, which are basically creating some of the havoc that we see on the planet. Look, there's going to be a one world global religious system here. There's going to be a global government. That's where they're headed, out of chaos order. Why would Merkel allow upwards of a million refugees, so-called refugees into her country? It's national suicide. Everybody knows it. It's deliberate. They're doing it deliberately because they're creating chaos throughout that entire continent. And they've already done it. I read an article today that over 50% of the entire French army, am I making this up? 50% of the entire French army is now stationed permanently in Paris. It's a war zone. It's a war zone. It's changed. It's all changed. And they can't go back. First of all, they don't have the gumption to go back to the way it was. They're already here. So we're being set up for a one world global government. But there's got to be an event that happens which changes everyone's paradigm. And again, I go back to this ancient prophetic text, which tells us very specifically that before the son of perdition is revealed, there's going to be what's known as the apostasy. And in the Greek, the word is apostasia. And it's where we get our word apostasy from. And it's an event, the apostasia, the apostasy. And it begs the question, what event would cause millions and millions and millions of people to abandon their existing worldview and paradigm and to embrace the lie?
Probably the destruction of all their technology through an EMP would probably do that. I was thinking more in terms of what if there's a group of people that have the technology and they also know the scriptures and things like that, but they're able to actually make earthquakes happen. They're able to shift weather systems, you know, technologies like HAARP. And then on top of that, you sure. think about the psychological effects of technotronic weapons where they can beam audio into somebody's head and they can hear it like it's inside their head. And then you think about the other possibilities of holographic projection satellites. People have been theorizing about Project Bluebeam for some time. And sure. then you got all simultaneous events. You could make people in the world see something, hear it, and actually see its effect. And you want to make a one world government, then it's got to be us versus them. You've got to stage an alien invasion. It's the only way to make everybody abandon their national sensibilities. What it means to be a human will go right out the window, because being human will mean one and only one thing. It's you versus the alien scum with the wonderful bosom of humanity that all live together in a loving jackboot fucking tyranny. I'm just taking a stab in the dark, you know.
I think it's well said. I mean, I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. The only thing, instead of blue beam, which I know exists and we all know, where is that coming from?
That is really weird. It might be coming through from the. It's not coming from the studio. It's not coming through from me, and it is coming through the Skype though. Somehow it's
really weird, yeah. It's like a show or something. I'm gonna get out of my Safari.
Yeah. Close down that Safari. Close down that Firefox. Close down that Opera. Close down that Chrome. Whatever the hell it is, let it be gone.
Let's see, maybe it was on my. But I checked it. It shouldn't have been there anyway. But look, I agree with you, except for one thing, that all my research in Watchers 7, we showed. This is with the late Dr. Roger Lear. We showed, which I'm sure you've seen the footage, the Kumburgaz UFO footage from Turkey. And
sorry, I haven't.
Okay. That craft was hovering for 5 hours. And we think it was an abduction. And it's on film. I mean, it's there. The Turkish government vetted the film. And we've shown it in our award-winning Watchers 7 show, shameless plug. But you know, when you get a craft like this in broad daylight that sits over any city, that just sits there, if it's one craft, if it's 10 craft, if it's a mile wide craft, it's game over. And you know, those, you know, the ancient alien guys, the UFO guys, Stephen Greer's of the world, they're all chomping at the bit because they know it's going to come. They know it's going to happen soon. So I agree with you in part. It's a very, very mixed bag. It's very, very complex. And I certainly don't have all the answers to it. And that's why we watch and we look and we blog and we write and we research and we talk. I mean, I've had, you know, lots because of what I do, I'm sure just like what you do. I mean, we get emails from people that have you know, been involved in stuff and come on, but they can't go public. They can tell me what happened or what they saw, but they can't go public with it. And I'm sure you've had stuff like that too. So,
yeah. And this reminds me of a point that Max Egan brought up, is that it's really important to not have an absolute 100% dogmatic view about things because of the complexity of the scenario. It's like, the wisest man is the man who knows that he doesn't know everything and can always learn more. Even a master at Kung Fu can always learn something new.
And that's why I tell my friends, hold on to all the prophecies extremely lightly. Hold on to everything that we see and we think we know. Hold on to it lightly, because the bottom line is we don't know. And we have to learn to adjust and move our thinking. There are certain things which are etched in stone. Okay, I get that. But other things, other prophecies, were like, for instance, Damascus, which we already talked about. You know, are we looking at the destruction of Damascus now? Is it a partial fulfillment? Surely something's up there. I mean, the place is a ruinous heap. In fact, I talked to an ex-Syrian guy who works in a cigar store. So I pop in from time to time, and I chat with this guy, you know, just because I want to know. And, you know, he drew a circle the size of, let's say, a 50-cent piece. And then he drew a larger circle, and he goes, the 50-cent piece is Damascus. Most of Damascus is okay. He goes, the surrounding area, dead zone. His words, not mine. Now, that was 3 months ago he told me that. And a lot's happened in 3 months. So I don't know how much of Damascus, and it's really hard to get any type of information from there at all.
Well, they might have to change the name to Demolished.
Yeah, it's not a good thing. And Assad is still in power, and the Russians are still there. So you're right. You know, I look at that, and I hold that prophecy loosely. I'm aware of what it says, but I'm not sure exactly how it's going to come down to be fulfilled.
Oh, my God. This reminds me of a realization that I had the other day. I had these little psychic moments, you know, when you try to do things or you think about something just before it happens, or maybe even it could be days or weeks or even years in advance, and you think that's going to happen for some reason. That's what happens, that exact same feeling when something corresponds with prophecy, when you see it in the world news, that exact same sensation when something corresponds with a thought that you had in your head that you didn't know why it is, and then suddenly you're having a conversation with someone where it becomes relevant all of a sudden, right? That's what it is to keep something in the back of your mind, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I know what you're talking about. That's very fascinating when stuff like that happens. When you get kind of nudged in a direction, or something's been on the back burner and then something triggers it, and you kind of go, oh my gosh, look at that. Very interesting.
Yeah, synchronicity. In my opinion, it's the universe's way of telling you that you're on the right track and to keep going.
Yeah.
There was this one time when I was thinking about giving up doing the radio and everything, and I got up in the morning and I was like, how many bills have I got here? I got the rent, I got the power, I got the phone and the internet bill and everything like that. That's $500. I don't have $500. Go in and check my PayPal and the donations, and guess what's in there? $500.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
You know, boom.
No, that's happened more than once in a variety of ways, which is, you know, that's really cool. When stuff like that happens.
Yeah. It's called life. It's what happens when you're busy making plans.
Thank you, Mr. Lennon.
And I feel that this is something that you get, I don't know, at a certain point in your life, synchronicity gets thrust upon you to the point where it's so blindingly obvious that you can't ignore it any longer. And for me, that time was when I came home from work and I went past the clothesline on my way up to the apartment. A little part in my mind said, Vinny, take that clothing off the line. It's going to rain, bro. It's going to rain. And I go, no. I'm going up to the apartment and I'm going to sit down. I'm going to relax. I had a tough day. All right. And of course, as soon as I get up to the apartment and open the door and sit down, the rain starts pissing down. I was like, God damn it! I have to obey my instincts. That's unfair, because my instincts tell me to do stuff that I don't want to do. And that means I have to force myself to do things that are good for me, like a parent does for their children. Holy shit! I'm an adult all of a sudden. Fuck! You know? And if you ever notice, as soon as you take your eye off the ball, that's when it smacks you in the face. When as soon as you think, yeah, I've got everything down, I'm like, boom! That's when it starts to knock you down and upside the head. We get arrogant. We get a little bit of hubris. Yeah. We think we know what's going on, but no.
That's a deadly combination. Arrogance and ignorance, deadly combination. I agree. Absolutely.
Hence the current state of America.
Pretty much.
I mean, it's like that scene in Die Hard with a Vengeance where you've got these two chemicals that are either one by themselves, they're kind of pretty benign, but if you mix them, boom, it blows up the place. I mean, everywhere going crazy left, right, and center. Doctor, I'm feeling really depressed because I'm not fulfilling my potential in life. Well, have you tried taking this drug that will make you commit suicide? No, I haven't. Thanks, Doc.
Oh, I know. Have you seen some of the drug commercials over here are just amazing? You know, they like they show some women with like a scarf on a beach and the sun, and she's like, you know, walking and the scarf is blowing. And while you're seeing this image, you know, may cause suicidal thoughts, you know, blah, 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 you know, so and so death in some place. I mean, it's just like, it's like, what? It's almost like a Monty Python sketch. I mean, it's like, except it's real. I mean, take the drug and have suicidal thoughts. No, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, this is the reason why my leading theory is that the comedians have become the newsmen, because the newsmen have become a joke.
Well.
And that's another thing. You talked about this cosmic battle. I found that the light side has an appreciation of irony. The dark side does not have a sense of humor.
Very much so. Very much so. I'll tell you something, just to give you an idea of the difference. In my Nephilim trilogy, I wrote, there's a lot of backstory here, but the bottom line is there was a line I used that one of these guys who was in league with these so-called extraterrestrials, as he leaves the ship, he mutters to himself, "There is no laughter here. There is no laughter here." Contrast that. And, you know, people don't, and this is part of what I do, okay, at conferences. When we read the biblical prophetic narrative, it's so easy to think that there's no humor in it, you know, because we get these guys in the pulpit, you know, and then the Lord came and said, go, you know, that type of thing. And there's actually some really, really funny stuff. I'll just give you an example, all right? So Yeshua, which is what Jesus' name is, in Hebrew, Yeshua, okay? So Yeshua is with his disciples. He's just done a bunch of stuff. He's just fed a bunch of people. And they're by the Sea of Galilee. And he goes to his disciples, "Hey, guys, get in the boat and start rowing out. I'll catch up with you later." What's wrong with this picture? What do you mean you're going to catch up with us later? But the disciples do this. They get in the boat and they start rowing out into the Sea of Galilee. We all know the story. Most of us have heard the story, but we fail to see the absolute humor. And Yeshua is basically goofing on these guys because he waits till it's just about dark. And then he decides to take a little stroll on the water. Now that's nuts. And I get that. That's completely supernatural. That defies our physics. We can't do that. But that's what the text says. Here's the humor in it. The gentle Jesus, the gentle guy that we all, you know, supposedly, but that's not what we got here. He'd be going, "Hey guys, don't freak out. It's just me. I'm walking." It's deliberate. It's deliberate. He walks about maybe 50 yards away from the boat. The disciples freak out. They think it's a ghost. That's just one thing. Now that to me is that's a guy thing. And you know what I'm talking about, Benny. That's the kind of stuff that guys do. Here's the other one. The crucifixion just happened. He's dead. He's in the grave. They can't figure out what's going on. Nobody gets it. Nobody understands what happened on Calvary, why he had to do it, why he did it, how that pays for everything, how it completely shifts the entire cosmos. But that's a three-hour discussion. We don't have time for it. The bottom line is the disciples are up in this upper room. They're all freaked out. The women are down below. All the doors are locked. They think they're next. They're probably saying, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Now, the gentle Jesus that we hear about in Sunday school would do this. "Hey, guys, I've just risen from the dead. It's me. Don't worry. Don't freak out." It's not what he does. He comes through the wall and just appears in their midst, and they get totally freaked out. you know, ah, it's a ghost. I mean, they're totally freaked out. And that's deliberate. That's deliberate. He's goofing on them. And then he says, and this is all in the text. He then says to them, hey, guys, what do you guys got to eat? And he sits down and has a piece of fish. There's another guy thing. You know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, the first thing he does, he goofs on him. He bursts through the wall and totally freaks him out. And that's, you see, we fail to see the humor in it because that's crazy. And he knows by doing that, he knows it's going to freak him out, but he does it anyway. He's goofing on him. He does it anyway. And he's all through the biblical prophetic narrative, that's what he does. And all that, amidst everything else that's supernatural, has been dismissed. And instead, we get guys with funny hats and garments and popes and confessionals and processions and Ave Marias and all this other nonsense, which has nothing to do with what happened. It's all man-made. It's all man-made, every bit of it.
Do you think that there's a way of cutting through the bullshit that is simple, you know? But there really isn't, is there? I found that isn't the truth, and particularly humor, something that's difficult to find. And because it's difficult to find, that's actually in part why it's so valuable.
Well, I think if it was any simpler, as my first mentor, Wayne Kendall, would say, humans wouldn't be able to do it. I think we come to a crossroads. Some of us come to a crossroads. Others never come to that. Or they come to the crossroads and they take one path. Others will take the other path. And when we come to that crossroad, we realize the depravity of our own hearts. We realize that we do stuff that we don't like to do, that we don't know why we do it, but we do it anyway, that we say things and we hurt people and we hold grudges and bitterness or whatever it is, you know, or we're addicted to something, or we've taken the drugs to medicate, and now we have no control over drugs, they control us. We come basically to a place where we cry out. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous will say, God, whoever you think he may be, higher power stuff. And that works because it takes, what it does is it strips down everything. Because for these people, they don't want to hear dogma, they need something. Because if they have another drink, they'll die. And I've talked to these people. I mean, I've talked to guys who were, they get the methamphetamines for 20 years, sitting in a jail cell with three felonies and cry out to God because they had nowhere else to go. And they were healed of the methamphetamine addiction. And the next day in court, the judge let them go on probation saying out loud, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I feel like I have to do it. And the guy was free on probation. He's now a pastor. So, you know, miracles like that happen. But the bottom line is there is a higher power. There is someone, but it's all free will. He'll never in a million years ever impose. Won't do it. You have to ask. But it's as simple as just asking. I asked 36 years ago. My life has never been the same. But that's, if it was any simpler, we wouldn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
But that's how it works, in my opinion.
Yeah, me I don't believe in religion, but I believe in a higher power. For one reason in particular, is one very interesting little statistic. It was the survival rates of POWs in Vietnamese prison camps, American POWs, and all the hardcore Christian American POWs that were in those camps with no hope of rescue, that kind of thing. Most of them survived. All the hardcore atheists who didn't believe that there was anything out there to believe in, most of them died. Ergo, if you've got a belief, doesn't matter what your belief is, if you hold on to that, doesn't matter what situation you're in, if you hold on to that belief, you can survive. That's where you draw your power from.
It's the same thing in Auschwitz. I read, I remember when I was 16, I read a book by Viktor Frankl, which changed my life. I mean, 16-year-old kid, and I get on this book, you know, An Introduction to Logotherapy. I mean, I had no idea what I was getting into here. And I read this thing, and, you know, he talked about that those who had no faith in something higher than themselves wouldn't last long. Some of them would just throw themselves on the electric barbed wire fence and die. Others would just give up and just die in their sleep. But those who held on, who had faith, made it through. Now, obviously not everyone did. Even those with faith would die of starvation, or they would be gassed or whatever. But you're right. Just like the Vietnam prison camps, it's the same thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're on the same page there. We may differ slightly in semantics, but I think and look, this is my first time on your show. So, you know, all I'm trying to do is get to know you a little bit so you can get to know me a little bit. So maybe when Watchers 10 comes out, I can really spill the beans with the new book and really talk about some of the discoveries, because I think you'll be interested in it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the whole idea of the show.
I
was just thinking about this the other day, actually, because I don't view talk radio as kind of competition. I view it as collaboration, right? There's a million people out there with really great ideas and things that I want to know about and hear about and talk to about interesting shit. Because honestly, I'm too intelligent to just talk about boring shit, to read a script or do anything like that. It would just drive me nuts. It'd be like being a cop and sitting there waiting for somebody to speed so that you can go after them. And you spend about 6 hours out of your seven-hour shift sitting on your ass doing nothing, wishing that something would happen. You know? That kind of shit. Fuck that.
Yeah. Or trying to make something happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it like if we met at a cafe and we just sat down and had a conversation, that's what the show's like.
And that's what we did. Mm. I mean, you know, the only difference would be it'd be face to face. I could look at your body language. You could look at mine, and, you know, look in each other's eyes, which is always good. But this has been a really good conversation, and I've really enjoyed it. And I'd love to come back on the show in the near future.
Well, as soon as you send me the information about exactly what time you're doing the release and so on and so forth, we'll make sure to roll out the red carpet for you. so there's that sorted. Now, we also have less than 10 minutes left in the clock here. You get to this point in a conversation where you're exhausted because you've been thinking for quite some time and you've been talking as well. People don't understand how exhausting that can actually be to have your brain firing on all cylinders for an extended period of time. And sometimes you run out of things to talk about. Other times you wonder about the next thing. Do you ever wonder about the next thing in your life? Like, at what point? Because for me, it's every now and again I start to feel, you know, like, hey, I'm comfortable and I've got enough money to, like, pay my bills and stuff. Uh-oh, something's wrong. I've got to get to the next point.
Yeah, you know, I'm 65 years old, and, you know, I look around and I got read the Riot Act a couple of years ago by my doctor. I was, you know, borderline type 2 diabetes. I was 35 pounds overweight. And I did something about it. I mean, I run like 4 or 5 days a week. I hit the gym 2 or 3 times a week. So, like, you know, I've lost the 35 pounds and I'm in probably the best shape of my life. But at 65, how much more time here do I have? 15 years, 20 years? I mean, my father passed away at 94. So there's longevity on the family. I get that. But, you know, you just don't know. And part of me, you know, I look around at like some friends and, you know, they're going, well, I'm going to retire this year. And that's what they've done. And I can't imagine retiring. I mean, that's not in my vocabulary. I mean, we just started a brand new TV show, ppsreport.com. And, you know, we're off to the races and producing a show a week plus daily updates, and which means a lot of work. And I love it because it's what I love to do. So it's not work. It's a passion. And, you know, we're probably going to go back down to Peru or Bolivia in the near future. And there's other sites to see. I mean, the investigation is just not ending. I mean, it just isn't. It just goes on because there's so many. Look, I've never been to the Great Pyramid and I want to go really, really badly. But there's so much unrest over there. But my good friend Brian Forrester is there as we speak. And apparently it's OK. And it's under CC, under the government. They've, you know, they're because they make most of their money through tourism. And so, you know, the kidnappings and all that nonsense is pretty much eradicated throughout Egypt. But, you know, that all can change in a heartbeat, too.
So you wonder exactly, just thinking about this, at what stage do you retire? Okay, well, yeah. I'm doing really inspiring work, answering and asking some of the most interesting and important questions that mankind has ever discovered. I'm traveling the world and I'm creating new award-winning pieces of work and things of that nature, which are elevating the understanding of the human race as a whole for anybody who wishes to see it and view it. Man, I should think about retiring. I mean, fuck this.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well said, my friend. Well said.
See, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. Other people have got a job, you know?
You're right. I hear you.
I mean, let's face facts. What was it? It was Mark Twain that said there's nothing more boring than a person that has a job.
Mm. Yeah, what'd you do today?
Well, the same thing I did yesterday.
Yep. Just a little bit more of it or a little bit less of it.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason why the movie Falling Down was such a smash hit success out of nowhere that it was. Because
I didn't see that.
Michael Douglas goes nuts because of a whole bunch of stuff. He shoots up the place and he steals stuff from people. He just basically somebody who's throwing down his briefcase and picking up a Glock 9mm, that kind of thing, going postal in a degree.
Right. Going postal, right.
All right. Now, what was interesting about the film is that many people took it as a sign of inspiration because it was an expression of how people really felt about their jobs, about society, about how society treated them, and about how they felt about themselves and what their potential was leading to in a society full of corruption, crime, stupidity, and people that don't care about anything.
Hmm. You know, there's a lot of people locked into the system, and you know, I remember we were driving someplace in Colorado from one conference out to take a couple of days off, and it was kind of late at night. And we pulled into there was nothing open out in the middle of nowhere, nothing open, but we found this little subway. So we pulled into the subway, and it was like 10 o'clock at night, and the thing was still open. And I walked up at the counter, and I smiled on my face, and said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" Guy looks at me, he shakes his head, he goes, "Living the dream." And we all just look at each other, he himself included, we all just broke up laughing. You know, there's so many people stuck in these, like, I'll just give you one example. I have a friend of mine, and this guy's like a really good electrician. He's an excellent electrician. He's highly skilled. But after, you know, 30 or 40 years of doing it, it's the same old every day. It's just, okay, I'm here twisting wires and I know how to do it. And there's a certain satisfaction in doing it really well. And that's what he does. I mean, he's really good. But on the other hand, he's always been looking at trying to change careers, except now he's 65. And he took all these courses. He thought about maybe flipping some houses and doing something like that. But he never gave himself the push out of a nest. He never took the leap of faith. And for those listening tonight, you know, there are people out there who have aspirations and have dreams. And, you know, unless we take that initial step and it's a leap of faith, you know, I mean, you never get there. You just never get there. You got to do it.
Life is a game. And in order to win any game, you got to take a few risks.
And, yeah, you do.
All right. And you know, what's life without risk? I'll tell you what a life without risk looks like. It looks like being scanned everywhere you go to buy anything that you want, to go anywhere that you feel like. It means being needing permission. It means not having a destiny. That's what a world without threat is.
Mm.
Give me danger. Give me discovery. Give me something new. Anything else is a waste of my time and my life.
Yeah, I agree.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Thank you very much for doing so, ladies and gentlemen. Bear in mind, this is listener supported. It is only being made because a lot of people went to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, started donating monthly, just like $1 a month, $5 a month, $10 a month, $50 a month. Doesn't matter. Whatever your means are, whatever you feel like, if you like the idea of somebody being a conversationalist and just having a conversation with these people who got really interesting shit to say, like L.A. Marzelli, then, bro, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, donate today, or start donating regularly right away. We'll catch you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.